issue which offended so many. What really bothered the many critics was the BBC linking Iraq's highest religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani, to sexual exploitation. Beloved by millions of Muslims worldwide and accredited with saving Iraq from terrorism, for Iraqis, seeing Sayyid Sistani questioned alongside low-ranking criminals went down badly with viewers.
It's very offensive. It's completely unacceptable. And that is why we wrote to the BBC and we highlighted that such association is completely unjustifiable and can never be accepted at all. Here is a man who has worked tirelessly to ensure that the rights of women are indeed looked after. And he himself has issued a number of instructions and decrees for the protection and preservation of the of women. And he condemned such practices as well. You know, when he was asked by the BBC itself, he issued a statement which said, "This is unacceptable."
During my travels, I headed down to the holy city of Karbala in southern Iraq. Karbala is one of the holiest places for Shia Muslims, with millions visiting its grand mosques every year to pay their respects to the Prophet's grandson Imam Hussein, who was martyred at this location 1,300 years ago.
What an amazing place. Just take a look at the background. Whether you're Sunni or Shia, you're going to love the architecture and the beauty of this grand mosque. Regardless of which sect you belong to, this place is beautiful.
The BBC came here too and spoke with Sheikh Ahmad Al-Asadi to see if the Ataba organisation, which administers the holy sites, condoned the practice.
They came to us to ask about our locations for marriage services and our procedures and services. During the conversation, we discussed mutter marriage. But when you look at the finished BBC programme, it focuses on illegal sexual businesses. From what they showed when they came to Ataba, they wanted to send a message to the world that Islam insults women, an issue which the West has actually, treating women as objects of lust for money. For us, marriage is a holy process. The BBC has no right to bring what the West believes about women and apply it to us.
Despite providing the BBC with detailed answers to their questions, Sheikh Al-Asadi's talk was edited down to an astonishing 28 seconds in the entire one-hour programme.
The ones who interviewed us were not honest. They didn't transfer anything we discussed. The interview lasted 35 minutes, but they were not professional and they didn't use most of what we discussed. They transferred just what they wanted and left the rest behind. The BBC treated us without justice or in a professional way. They treated us like an intelligence agency would treat an interrogation suspect. The Ataba was targeted in this program after Grand Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa to fight Daesh. They wanted to knock down the Ataba and show a black image about us.
The BBC clearly wasn't making any friends, but was the documentary trying to mislead people about Iraq?
After speaking to the same individual that the BBC spoke to here inside the Ataba, it is very clear that there is a degree of resentment towards the BBC for the type of filming that they did here. Obviously, this was an important subject which needed to be highlighted, but the problem is the BBC appears to have launched a character assassination campaign against the most senior figures here in Iraq, including the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani.
Following our talk, I decided to look into what these scholars are up to myself. In particular, the work spearheaded by the organisations associated with the holy mosques.
So, just one of the many things which the organisation has set up to help deal with the people's needs is hospitals, in particular since the outbreak of the coronavirus. This, of course, has been vitally needed as the government in Iraq hasn't been able to fulfil the needs of the people, especially during a global pandemic which nobody anticipated would arrive.
I visited schools, hospitals, orphanages, universities, and charities. including ones that assist women who had lost loved ones during the horrific war against Daesh. None of this was shown by the BBC.
We have two projects with UN support. The first is related to helping Iraqi women, including the young who receive abuse in society. The second helps to protect refugees from the wars who may have been abused too.
With so many discrepancies already being discovered, I wanted to find out what else the BBC had conveniently forgotten to mention. Back in London, I got in touch with Iraqi activists who had been rigorously researching the BBC's claims and findings. Due to fear of repercussions for their work, we have chosen to protect their identity. What they found was stunning.
We found more than 73 mistranslations within the documentary. One single documentary by one of the largest media corporations in the world. 73 mistranslations. None of the individuals who are accused of misconduct in the documentary are linked in any way to the shrines. None of those individuals have committed any of those crimes inside the shrines or indeed with any cooperation with anyone from those shrines. The shrines and these criminals do not have any links, and yet the BBC were very clearly pushing this narrative to the audience that the shrines had something to do with this misconduct and this abuse and these crimes they were trying to report on. Again, shifting the focus away from the real criminals. What they have demonstrated is cowardice, or there seems to be a narrative they were following instead of the truth.
Many senior Muslim groups complained to the BBC following the documentary's release. However, the BBC's replies have been more than a little disappointing.
As a result of the investigation and the information we have gathered and the detailed analysis of the documentary, we started sharing our findings in a formal way to the BBC. We lodged a complaint to the BBC and said to them very clearly, laid down the details of the findings, including the mistranslation, including the factual errors they had, including the lack of balance and objectivity when they were representing information, including the way they failed the real victims by ignoring some really difficult areas. Areas of violence and abuse. But throughout the process, they were making corrections, to be fair to them. They were making corrections, of course, after millions had watched the erroneous, mistake-filled version. But even after they were making these corrections, neither did they admit, nor did they announce, that they were making the correction. So they did it in a very subtle and sneaky way.
They denied responsibility, they denied liability, and they completely let their credibility and their professional responsibility down.
After the programme went live, anger in the community spread rapidly. Action was taken, including a petition to cancel the documentary and coordinated press releases.
And this indeed
Sheikh Mohammed Al-Hilli was one of the many prominent Muslim speakers who condemned the film as Islamophobic.
When you watch this particular documentary, is the an idea that somehow Shia Muslims are supportive of such practices, or at least they're silent about it. Of course, the other problem I had personally with the documentary is the lack of representation and the opportunity for scholars who are able to speak English, or at least from the Shia community, to present their opinion regarding what was going on.
Despite the information being provided to the BBC of their inaccuracies, no action was taken to correct the issues, despite the BBC's promises to do so. Another prominent voice of damnation came from Ayatollah Milani. Known and respected in both Iraq and the UK, he informed me that the BBC had an obsession with Mutta going back years.
This is unfortunately not the first time that BBC does that. 5 years ago, they interviewed me about the temporary marriage. And in details, I explained the history of that and all the principles of that in a very clear way. I provided the presenter with a copy of my book, Islamic Family Law, where a chapter in that is discussing in details the whole idea and concept of temporary marriage. But unfortunately, when they produced it and it was broadcasted, I found that a lady was interviewed, and she said after my work and my interview that temporary marriage is like prostitute. And when they asked me, I mean the producer of this BBC video, when they asked me about my opinion and to interview me, I said, look, I have a very bad experience from the previous time.
All this was enough to upset Iraqis, but I noticed other issues yet unhighlighted.
The fact that the BBC continuously mentioned irrelevant points, such as the criminals claiming to be descended from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, combined with the journalist using her own personal views, such as claims that Sharia law grants fewer rights to women, adds that with the use of subliminal messaging, such as the constant use of mosques and holy sites throughout the entire programme, all appears to be aimed at convincing the audience that Islam is an oppressive religion. Now, that's very interesting, given the fact that the programme also failed to mention, even once throughout the entire hour-long documentary, the 2003 British-supported invasion and occupation of Iraq. Now, that is very interesting, given that the invasion totally destroyed the country, impoverished millions, and left so many vulnerable to criminal elements in society, particularly Iraqi women.
But would the BBC do all this knowingly? I spoke to one former BBC staff member to find out.
Can the BBC honestly claim that they are impartial?
One of the things that the BBC says when it's espousing its vision around the world, usually through the arm of BBC World Service, it's the idea that we are objective, we are impartial, and we are unbiased. These things cannot be true when you're dealing with the news. Sometimes there's a guilty party, sometimes there's an innocent party. Through omission, through a choice of whether or not to include a particular voice, to downplay a particular voice, or even the omission of a particular story, you're making it quite clear what side of the argument you're on. Now, when I worked for the corporation, like most of the journalists who were employed, I was there on a freelance basis. I was there as a presenter, as a producer in the London section. And you saw policy-making decisions. When I oversaw decisions being made, they were clearly done through a chain of command. So you couldn't just come up with a story and independently go and deal with it. You would have to go through an editor, through a producer, perhaps even through a line manager. Lawyers would check over your content from time to time. I mean, we'd even have the pronunciation department call you up and say, that's not quite how you say that name. Now, all of these things are being done for checks and balances, but they're also being done with one eye on, is this the kind of stuff we want to run? Is this the kind of stuff that will make us look bad? Does this represent core BBC value stuff?
Back in Kardemir, I decided that the only thing missing from my investigation was the criminals themselves. So before leaving Iraq, I decided to try and find those involved in abusing the mutter practice.
Now, the way it was described at the time by the journalist reporting in the documentary was like she was almost entering into a red light district. It was a shady area which did questionable marriage services. But actually, on the contrary, there is a very family atmosphere here. This place is, you know, where people bring their children to come and visit one of Shia Islam's holiest sites. There are markets here, many shops, and Iraqi society is very conservative. So for anyone to be conducting practices which could be compared to prostitution openly in a place like this would certainly not be tolerated by the local community or by the authorities which patrol this area on a day-to-day 24-hour basis.
Speaking to locals, it became immediately clear that those exposed by the BBC had a poor reputation to begin with.
They just brought someone from the street. He is not educated in the religion. When you want to talk about anything, you need to bring a specialist.
It wasn't long before we found the brother of Raad, Rawad Al-Kabur. Raad was one of the men exposed by the BBC in their documentary. Rawad agreed to speak to us about the BBC and his brother's conduct.
My brother has no office or license. He's not authorized to do any marriage contract. These people, they just lied to say something bad about Raad and Islam. If I see anyone doing unlicensed mutter marriage, I would insult them and their great-grandfathers.
After attempting to defend his brother, we asked if he would bring us to Raad for further scrutiny. Raad, however, refused to show himself. We also failed to track down Sheikh Salawi, who was also filmed by the BBC. However, we were told by researchers that he was not a recognised scholar and didn't represent any mosque, Ataba or Sistani's office.
Our investigation took multiple dimensions. One of the dimensions was to go on the ground and identify those individuals. Who they are? Who do they represent? What qualifications do they have? Do they really exist? And that investigation very quickly uncovered that someone called Sayyid Raad was not a Sayyid. He has absolutely no qualification, no religious background, yet he was represented by the BBC as a cleric. We told them that, by the way, you haven't done your due diligence by looking after who these people are. But they denied that and said, no, we have done our due diligence. We asked to see evidence of that, but they failed to answer.
Documentary, in as far as presenting this, is not necessarily, we are not necessarily in any shape or form objecting to the presentation of this abuse. But we have to remember this, that in many war-torn countries, such abuse takes place. This is no justification. But it doesn't matter whether you're Shia, you're Sunni, you're Hindu, you're Jew, you're Christian. This kind of practice happens all around the world, and it's wrong, it's completely unacceptable. But to somehow continuously frame it to be a Shia thing, which the name of the documentary, which the documentary itself continuously sought to do, was something that, of course, we are completely unhappy with. And we voiced our concerns through legitimate means, through a very well presented and researched document, which involved research in Iraq to go and speak to offices where somehow these rogue elements were working and issuing marriage certificates to young children and so on, where we've investigated how these people who are doing it have no relation whatsoever with the seminary, have no relation whatsoever with the clerical establishment, have no relation whatsoever with Ayatollah Sistani. They just happen to be criminals.
Now, of course, no one would have a problem with the BBC over its coverage of women being mistreated in Iraqi society. Obviously, it is a problem, and regardless of who covers it, it is, of course, something which is greatly important. However, the problem with the programme is that it seems to have purposefully missed out key aspects of the story here in Iraq. The way in which the film was styled seems to suggest that the Iraqi religious leadership has purposefully neglected Iraqi women, especially those most in need, and has also failed to police the practice of muta or temporary marriage, both of which is actually not the case, as we've seen in our time here in Iraq.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. Regarding the divine duties, people are of three kinds. Some people accept the duties and do it. Some others flee doing the duties. Yet, there are some others who act against the divine duties and are an enemy to them. The third group shows their enemy towards the orders of Allah explicitly and believes that there is no obligation in religion. However, the first group is those who accept the orders of Allah and try to do them completely. They act based on whatever Allah has ordered. One good example among the faithful people who apply Allah's orders are Prophet Ismail and Prophet Ibrahim. After so many years, when Prophet Ibrahim came back to Mecca, Allah, in order to test him, ordered him to sacrifice his son Ismail. Prophet Ibrahim accepted the order of Allah and told his son Ismail, "I'm given the order of Allah to make a sacrifice, and you, my son, are the great sacrifice." In other words, Prophet Ibrahim, without hesitating a moment, listened to Allah's order and never acted against it. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
RTIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and we are here to present yet another episode of A Muslim Lady. If you remember, we have been discussing different issues regarding Muslim lady. I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me in the studio, my wife, Razia Batul Najafi. Assalamu alaikum
wa rahmatullah. Wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. I'm so glad that we are continuing the beautiful subject after a long time. And I was truly missing the amazing teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam regarding our issues as a Muslim woman.
Muslim lady. Alhamdulillah, we have discussed and we have presented so many ahadith and narrations regarding Muslim ladies' issues, So we were discussing the beautiful hadith of Lady Fatimatu Zahra, salamullah alayha, the beautiful story, astonishing story, narrated by our 11th Imam, Imam Hasan Askari alayhi salam, And towards the end, the Lady Fatimatu Zahra, salamullah alayha, says that I have heard my father, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, saying that our Shia ulama, our Shia scholars, they will be resurrected in the day of judgment. They will have a dress, the beautiful divine dress, according to their knowledge status. As much knowledge they will have, you know, they will have that much beautiful and valuable dress, the heavenly dress.
Exactly. And you know why she's mentioning about the heavenly dress, especially on the day of resurrection? Because some people, or most of the people, will be naked. You know, because they were not having the good qualities like piety and taqwa and knowledge and ilm and, you know, all the sacrifices in this dunya. As many as good deeds you have sincerely, you have done in this dunya, that means you have libasu taqwa. And if you don't have it, that means you are resurrecting, you know, naked.
Without anything,
So that would be such a big, you know, respect and honor to not only having a dress, but having a heavenly dress, and not only having it, you are providing, you are spreading, you are sharing, you know, to others, that she has mentioned. Here she said, one of scholar, one of a learned person who has acquired knowledge with sincerity, that person can have maybe millions of
thousands of clothes of lights, khil'atu nur, nur of Jannah,
nurani
of
garments,
divine. And what does it mean? They will just have the clothes, nurani cloth, or it means they will have such a lofty and high status in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It means definitely they will have high status, And not only having so many nurani or light dresses or clothes, but they will have the high status, lofty status, and it means they will do shifa to the believers, the other believers, definitely.
Yeah.
That is the important thing.
Exactly. Look. And, you know, it has written in Hadith that once these scholars, and learned ones, receive these honorable clothing and the garments from Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala, then the caller will announce, Munadi will give this nida, that those who sponsored the orphans of Ali Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, because you are just sponsoring them, you are just taking care of yatim and orphans of Ali Muhammad, means the people, they are
the believers, the followers of the Aima Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, they are called Aitamu Ali Muhammad.
Because these are
the fathers. You know, Ahlul Bayt are like fathers, parents for us. So we are under their supervision, like their custodianship.
Yeah, and we are far away from their knowledge. Yeah, like, I don't know what my imam wants from me. Yeah, I'm very weak in ahkam, in rulings of Islam or in tafsir. So if someone is teaching me, that means I'm a yatim, I'm an orphan, and that person is just sponsoring me.
So let me clear that Aitamu Ali Muhammad means like, you know, an orphan, he or she lose their parents. Yeah, they're especially father.
Yeah.
So likewise, we are yatim because we have lost the knowledge, we have lost the connection, you know, we are far away from the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. So we are called Aitam Ali Muhammad. So whoever acquires knowledge, so he's not yatim, he will have close relations with Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam.
Therefore, the caller will announce again, oh, those who connected them, the aitam, the orphans, who were cut off their imams back to the path, come here. Because you are the beautiful connection between the orphans and imam. Then the caller will say again that, look here, oh people, these are your scholars. You lifted the orphans of the Ahlul Bayt just as they gave other the dress of knowledge in the world. Give them a heavenly garments as their reward. So the reward is the heavenly garment which they are receiving because of their amazing way of tabligh and propagating the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam.
So we are going to have a short break. Please, listeners, don't go away. Stay tuned. Inshallah, we will come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. The Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, again continues the beautiful saying of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Then she says, the caller will say, for the general public, the general believers, the scholars will be ordered to give them this khil'ah, this beautiful heavenly clothing. Yeah, so it means not only the scholars themselves will have this status, they will give this khil'at, this heavenly clothes to the believers.
Helping, supporting, giving respect to others, you know, especially on that day of resurrection. I love the way Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha is giving a beautiful vision to Muslim lady that, oh ladies, your life should have very high purpose. You know, look at the hadith of Rasulullah, you know, in her life, like the way when she listened to this hadith of her father, how she acted upon it, because she was keep having a very clear vision in her life. She has divided her weekdays, you know, to spreading this noor, this
despite
light. Yeah,
having all the house chores and all the kids, you know, still she would spare extra time to spread this beautiful life.
Yeah, that is, you know, like meaningful life, fruitful life. Usually nowadays, we as a Muslim ladies, we have this question. you know, this confusion that, you know, what is my duty? Shall I seek knowledge? This is the path, you know, a beautiful direction which Bibi is showing, that if you can cope, you can easily do.
Because even, you know, helping and doing your house chores is also like acquiring knowledge. If you are walking on the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then it does not matter whatever you are doing. You are gaining knowledge, you are, you know, helping your children, you are doing house chores, as long as your intention is.
My question is here that, yeah, sometimes you can do ibadat, sometimes you can seek knowledge, So therefore we say one alim is better than, for example, 70 worshipper, abid,
Definitely.
So when we are working at home, that is ibadat, no doubt, because if my niyat, my intention is purely for Allah. But if I'm just doing house chore, and I, you know, usually in our society, we don't have good seeker of knowledge, but I'm just doing house chore, I'm not learning anything.
I don't have that thirst. You are right. But I'm saying if she does not find time because of, you know, children and house chores, and she wanted to acquire knowledge, she knows the value of knowledge, definitely she will get the reward of that knowledge. But if she fulfills her all duties inside the house, then acquires knowledge, definitely she will have the high status, the whole reward.
She will get sawab, a reward of that intention. Yeah, intention. Why? We all know that women's life is full of ups and downs, and she should be very flexible about her patience. You know, if she really wanted to acquire knowledge, but because of some other duties, she is delaying it. Yeah, like my intention is so pure and I have a very good determination, willpower. Then here and there, I will take some time out and I will listen to some lectures, for example. I will call some scholars and I will get it. Your point is right that because of niyat and intention, she will get sawab. But we are getting so much this direction and knowledge that Lady Fatimatu Zahra, truly, truly, absolutely, she's just shining there, and guiding us that, look, I am the role model of you, you know, especially as a woman. So look at me, look at my challenges of life, but look how I spend my day-to-day life with so much purpose. As a Muslim lady, sometimes we are wasting our time because maybe we truly didn't understand the status, the lofty status of scholars and ulama, you know, in the eyes of Islam and Lady Fatimatu Zahra salamullahi alayha. Otherwise, we as a Muslim, as a mother, you know, I have to be the most educated one. Education doesn't mean the degree. Education means, you know, something which is really useful in my day-to-day life. And I think this hadith, this amazing hadith of Lady Fatima ends with such a beautiful news. Yeah. Which is what?
Yeah, in the last sentence of this beautiful hadith, she says, one thread of this heavenly clothing is a million times better than all those things which receive the sun's light on this world, you know?
Wow.
One single thread is better than a million times better than whatever on this earth has received the sun's light. Yeah. This is very, very big and huge. And it's out of our imagination.
Yeah. Look, when I'm reading this hadith of Lady Fatima, you know, I automatically get all that energy, and eager to learn more, not only learn to teach teach more as a Muslim lady. That is my point. And that is missing in our society.
Yeah.
You know, mostly in our dramas, in our movies, what they show, that man is reading a book or reading a newspaper, but women is just watching to the dramas, you know.
Unfortunately, we are
yes, inshallah, we will change our perspective of life by the beautiful guidance of Lady Fatimah Zahra.
Inshallah. Dear listeners, thank you so much for being with us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing National Bird, directed by German filmmaker Sonja Kennebec. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph and many other outlets. And beside him, we have Dan Glazebrook, who's a journalist, political analyst and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, National Bird follows the harrowing journey of three US military veteran whistleblowers determined to break the silence surrounding the US's secret drone war. Tortured by guilt for their participation in the killing of faceless so-called suspects abroad, and despite the threats of being prosecuted, these three veterans offer an unprecedented look inside this secret program to reveal the haunting cost of the US's global drone strikes.
You literally just kind of hover, and you would wait until he walked out to the field to meet with some friends for something, and you'd blow him up. Drop a Hellfire missile on him. Maybe we killed our objective, maybe we killed a guy who we thought was our objective. You don't know.
When I first got into the military, I was thinking it was a force for good in the world. I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was.
I still have a top secret clearance, so I have to be extraordinarily cautious about what I can and can't say on camera.
My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, and identify everything.
And left it near the rear of the SUV.
That's deceptive. You get the opinion that you're at 10,000 feet, you see this photograph. You know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. You know what you see in two dimensions.
You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them.
It's too easy. They just embolden commanders.
But the party began.
Because there is no threat.
Oh, sweet target.
I mean, this could grow to get so out of control.
Somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door shoved FBI badges in my face.
The Espionage Act is one of the most serious charges you can level against an American.
That I'm probably going to get indicted and I'm probably going to get charged.
I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program. It's a secret program. I can't just go telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, it's frightening.
first of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Sonia Kennebec, the director, she won an award for this documentary with the Nation Institute. And she said in her award acceptance speech that she initially set out to make this documentary solely just about drones and drone warfare. But then it developed into something much more than this. Of course, we learn of the stories of the three characters in the documentary. And she wanted to focus also on the consequences of whistleblowing and espionage and all these sorts of issues. And Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, you can always tell there's something in the air, both literally and figuratively in this case, when filmmakers start making films about the same kind of thing. So in recent years, we've had three or four movies on the subjects of drones. We've had this, we've had a documentary called Drone, which is a slightly more arty and abstract version of this story. But we've also had feature films like Good Kill with Ethan Hawke as a drone pilot and Eye in the Sky, a British film with Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren. So there's clearly something going on that filmmakers, that they want to be a part of this conversation. And I think part of the situation is that we are still all, we're all making our way through this moral maze at the moment. We're all dealing with the ramifications of drone technology. We're trying to figure out what the consequences are, the good points and the bad points. And I think filmmakers like Sonia Kennebec here, they all want to have a say in that conversation.
And of course, so as you said, there's been a resurgence in this topic of drone warfare and the moral obstacles around it. And we've had, this documentary had Wynne Wenders as the executive producer, of course, is a multi-winning, award-winning German filmmaker. How much impact do you think he had in this documentary?
Well, he's one executive producer, and he, you know, Wynne Wenders in the past has had an interest in surveillance technology. He made a very interesting film at the end of the last century called The End of Violence, which is about surveillance technology in America as it was back then, and obviously things have moved on very rapidly from that. The other executive producer is Errol Morris, who is, you know, a revered documentarian and has made things like The Fog of War in the past. So he himself is also very interested in this subject matter. So it obviously helps a young up-and-coming filmmaker when you can get two great filmmakers, two revered filmmakers within the industry to put their names on the credit of the film. And, you know, it all ties in with some of the work they've done in the past.
And Dan, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on National Bird?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but to be honest, I find this quite often with films on this subject, the tendency to focus on the emotional turmoil of the operators and really the perpetrators. I find, to be honest, slightly distasteful, really, given that the primary victims, obviously, of drone warfare are the people getting blown up and getting their legs blown off and so on. And they do feature in the film, and they have quite an extended section in Afghanistan talking to the victims, but you never get the feeling that they get the same full kind of personhood ascribed to them by the filmmaker. You don't see this sort of rich emotional life that's depicted of the operators and the perpetrators, and I feel like that's actually is playing into the hands of the dehumanization that allows things like the drone program to exist. Because yes, Afghans are in the film, but they're really there just as victims who you know kind of walk around and then get bombed. There's no real feel of what it's like for them, what their lives are like. So I find it difficult.
I see your point, Dan, but one could argue that the role of whistleblowers and journalists, of course, shine a light on these issues, otherwise that would be ignored. And I think Sonia probably emphasizes this in the documentary.
Absolutely, and you know, that what they've done to come out against the program is commendable. But I think even to kind of do justice, if you like, to the operators depicting the film themselves, you know, what turned them against what they're doing is that at some point they had a realization, my God, these are human beings that I'm killing. They're just like me or my mom or my neighbor. And I don't think that realization that's led to them being racked by guilt is fully given to us as a viewer. And I think that's problematic.
Well, that's a really interesting point. We'll have to pause there just for now.
I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually pushed the button
I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. We can't just bomb someone and fly away. We have to follow through. The bomb hit and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see, like, the body parts. You can identify, like, that could be the lower half of his body, and that could be a leg. And then sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or, like, pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket, and a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry him back to their compound.
So it's Heather Limber. So you really feel for her in this documentary. Indeed, the other characters also, but she seems to come across as the one most plagued and crippled by guilt for her role in the drone program. Mike, what do you make of how her character is portrayed?
Well, she's not a million miles away from the Ethan Hawke character in Good Kill, the feature film that came out a couple of years ago, in that, you know, she was very much in the room watching this footage come in. And the sense that I got from her watching this film is that it's very different from being a soldier on the ground. If you're a soldier on the ground, you know pretty much that you killed someone if you haven't killed someone. The sense that I get from her, the issues that she's working through are connected to the fact that nobody has told her who she's killed, how many people she's killed. This is hanging over her. And you get a sense of this issue bearing down on her. It's like she's got something over her head. And that is a very powerful thing.
And Dan, I know you say the true victims are, of course, the targets of the drone strikes. But in this documentary, you see Heather and the others almost come across as victims in their own right, and perhaps particularly connected to the US military's recruitment campaigns. I mean, it's sold off, as you see, as a glorious sort of career you could have, and that you're on the right side of history and justice. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, certainly. They are victims as well. They're, I mean, secondary victims, I would say, but certainly, I mean, they're recruited into it pretty much as children, and to talk about the majority of drone operators being 18 to 24, so they're recruited at 18, practically children, but they'll be kind of groomed effectively from 16, 17. If you think about the involvement of the Pentagon with the video games industry, they're really being groomed from the age of whenever they start playing video games, 8, 7, 6, into this role. So it's really, it is a form of institutional child abuse within America, you know, what America's doing to its own children, and here in this country in Britain as well, same thing. So, certainly, and of course they're sold, as you say, the idea of being on the right side of history. One of the people involved in the program said,
"I have this real sense of moral righteousness, and that they set out to do the right thing. Yeah. They had good intentions at heart."
Exactly, but it's it is child abuse, and you see the impact, and the fact that they're not even allowed to talk to therapists because the therapists don't have security clearance. So the other thing that they would want to discuss is classified. And so on. So absolutely, the treatment of them by the military is shocking. And you hear testimony from Heather in the film that her kind of commanding officers were constantly questioning her judgment. She was saying, "I think there's women and children here," and so on. And they're saying, "Are you sure? I don't think so. Let's fire anyway." And being overruled and so on. Absolutely. They are victims as well. I just don't think they're the primary victims.
That's a good point. And Mike, I just really quickly want to talk about the shots that are used in this documentary. We see a lot of aerial shots. And do you think the director did this intentionally to give the Western viewer the sense of what it's like to be watched? Because a lot of the shots are in US sort of suburban areas.
Yeah, I mean, the film sort of flips on its head halfway through, and we get a sense that the people who've been employed as watchers are now the watched. And that is very much there in all those drone shots over American cities, American towns. Drones have revolutionized the way movies in general have been made, because now it's much cheaper to do aerial shots rather than hiring big bulky crane equipment. You can just fly a plane or fly a drone above people's heads. So that has changed as well, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so many films on this subject. The technology, the form and the content are married in this respect.
I think one of the strengths of the documentary, it shows how barbaric and brutal drone strikes are. And Mike, if I could ask you, what did you make of this journey to Afghanistan and this story?
I liked it very much. I mean, we see so many documentaries that set out their case in the first hour and then spend the second hour driving home the same points over and over again. Here, I think you get a sense of a story developing in real time. There was a sense that this technology has been thrust upon us, and like I say, we're all making and negotiating our way through this moral maze. And when it does finally get to Afghanistan, you get a sense there, from that clip, the plane comes over, of just how normalized this kind of life has been. I mean, the fact it's called National Bird, would suggest that the drone has now become part of the natural order of things, part of the landscape for so many people, in ways both good and terrifying.
That's a really interesting point. And Dan, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Mike just said? What did you make of the journey to Afghanistan in this documentary?
Well, I was glad they included it, because about 40 minutes into the film, I thought, are we going to hear anything from any Afghans whatsoever? And they did spend an extended period of time in Afghanistan. But as I said, I still didn't feel really they came across fully as agents. They were still depicted as, okay, they were shown as suffering and as victims, but there's portrayed as only victims, just kind of passive recipients, really, of U.S. air power. There was no agency there. No narrative, no Afghan narrative was present, and there was no politics whatsoever in the film. And I think there's a real danger. The Glasgow Media Group carried a really interesting study out a few years ago on the Palestine-Israel conflict, and they found that a lot of journalists were quite sympathetic to the Palestinians, but they knew that they weren't really allowed in Western media to actually put forward a Palestinian narrative about resistance to occupation and so on. So instead of that, in place of that, they just paraded an endless parade of Palestinian suffering, but overlain with an Israeli narrative to justify it. Mm-hmm. And I think the danger, by not giving any kind of Afghan narrative, we just see, okay, we see the Afghan suffering, but there's no narrative, there's no other side of the story. The danger is that you have the same thing with the Palestine-Israel conflict, which people have pity for the Palestinians, but the overall view in the West, whenever Israel attacks, is, well, it's a sort of necessary evil in the war against terrorism. It's terribly sad, and we pity them, but it kind of has to be done. And I think there's a danger this film will have the same effect. People feel sorry for the Afghans, they'll pity them, but won't necessarily just see, oh, it's a shame these innocent bystanders die and so on, but that's kind of necessary.
Mike, so would you have liked to see more political context to this documentary?
There's certainly scope for a more comprehensive and possibly slightly drier documentary about drone technology and the politics of deployment. I mean, this is not a film about the systemic application of drone technology. It's not about the technological specifics of it. It is a human story, and those are the documentaries that tend to get sold at international marketplaces, play at festivals these days, because they're very easy to relate to. Mm-hmm. I still think we're in the early days of the, like I say, the early days of this technology, and there will be a more comprehensive documentary than the ones that we've seen so far. But in terms of a primer of how this affects both the watched and the watchers, I thought it was pretty solid.
Mm. Well, thank you for that point.
This is global. This is getting information anywhere at any time, shooting people from anywhere at any time, and it's not just one person sitting there with a little remote control, a little joystick, moving around a plane that's halfway across the world. That's not all there is. It's like borders don't matter anymore, and there's a huge system that spans the globe that can just suck up endless amounts of your life, your personal data. I mean, this could grow to get so out of control. And we're not the only ones that have this. This is going to be commonplace, if it's not already. It's a secret program. And what that means is that I can't just go shouting off the hilltops telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, one person who worked within this massive thing, it's frightening.
So, Mike, in the documentary, we hear from President Obama give a televised speech talking about the drone warfare operation. And he says how it operates in such a way to ensure minimal loss of life and that they're precise and surgical strikes. Of course, in the documentary, we learn that it isn't really that precise. And Daniel even says, one of the characters, that an element of guesswork is involved. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, I mean, everyone does seem to be operating in some kind of grey area. I mean, we've seen from the clips that actually the images that the drones beam back to the operators in America are very fuzzy. I mean, there's a degree of ambiguity in those very images, never mind in the ethics of using this technology. And so what's interesting is what the film says about the way this technology has been sold to us. So it's clearly been sold to young army recruits as an exciting new development in the war on terror. And we've seen we see the adverts in the films that are all, they are like an advert for a computer game, as you say. But there's also a degree to which you think someone must have sold President Obama on this, that this is a new